Welcome to the Blockchain Practitioners Podcast, where we interview founders, leaders, professors, and experts in the blockchain industry about the projects they are working on. On this podcast, we try to learn something new about an industry which will, in a few years, affect the lives of us all. My name is Steven, and I'm your host for this episode. My next guest studied at the University of British Columbia, and he's the founder of Space, their tagline, the future of metaverse social commerce. Space is a community-centered metaverse e-commerce platform. He's also the co-founder and vice chair of OMA3. They are creating standards and protocols for the open metaverse. You're listening to an interview with Batis Samadjian. So, welcome to the podcast, Batis Samadjian. It's great to have you here. And I was wondering if you could introduce yourself.
Hey, Stephen. Pleasure to be here today. Yeah, of course. So I'm Batis Samadjian. I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Space, which is focused on commerce as a solution for the metaverse. So 3D commerce, virtual stores in the metaverse. That's what we've been up to. Great to be here.
It's a super, super interesting topic, I think, because we're talking about the future here of Web3, but also sales, economies, all that stuff. But let's go back. One of the things I always try ask people when I interview them is, how did you get into blockchain and digital currencies and all that stuff?
Cool. Yeah, so my funny story is while I was in college in UBC in Vancouver, me and a couple of my friends started mining out of our college dorm. And the way we found out about it was we were at this fraternity party and this guy whispers to my friend, they're like, oh, what are you guys up to? We're like, well, just studying you. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of going to quit. I'm mining crypto. I've got this big Twitter following. And we're like, what is he talking about? And basically the next 3 days, it was just like something that was like itching and bothering us. So we kept like trying to understand what is he talking about, and eventually understood that there's this potential that you're basically mining a new type of asset out of a cloud, right? Or out of the virtual ground. And it got us really excited. And every day after that just became like paradigm shift for our life, you know, like we started to learn about the tech behind it. We actually started, actually my friend started the Bitcoin Club, but we started it together. We started to find all kinds of people across campus who understand it. And what was really cool is, you know, I would say there's a couple places in the world where like you were less of an alien, at least between 2011 and 17. And what was quite cool is that, so we did it in 2013 at the start of the year. And we learned from a few people that there are some Bitcoin ATMs and some network traders that are within the city. And that was very, like, it helped us, help bring a lot of sanity to a very, like, unsure industry, you know, like seeing the machines, seeing that there's people you can actually meet up with on the map. It helped kind of like justify for us what we're up to. And then, of course, as soon as the Bitcoin casinos came around and the first few exchanges, it all helped make it all a lot more real. We are one of those Quadrata survivors, by the way, Quadriga survivors. So that was a wild trip.
Yeah, so you've been in the game for a long time now.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Am I right that you're the founder of Space?
That's so right. Yeah.
Tell me about it. How did you come to founding it, and what is it actually?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So Space is a commerce virtual world. So essentially, what this means is that it's a virtual world focused on the creator economy where people can create their own virtual stores, they can create their own subscription rooms, they can create their own ticketed events. They can also create combined propositions that function like exclusive drops where it's an event with an exclusive product drop. And the main thing is that we made it incredibly easy to create the virtual store. So my kind of narrative of like how I got into this is before I was doing Space, I was the head of product for a 15-minute delivery startup in London called Zap. And quite a lot of my friends from the LA area that have been working in VR and in the video game industry forever, like plus 20 years, were like kind of telling me that, like, hey, you know, this is like a area you should be taking a look at. We're like really curious about it, and you're the kind of guy who gets obsessed about these topics. So let's talk more about it, you know? And my friend Chance Glasgow, who's one of the co-founders of Call of Duty, he was already working on a VR meeting app that I had tried a year prior. And we were just, we were just jamming, conversing about like what they're up to, what are they learning. And I think over a couple of days, we had all like played around quite a few of the social world experiences, come to understand like how have MMORPGs advanced, what are the new practical use cases, where are the sticky experiences, and came to a conclusion that like, well, we probably don't want to start another meeting app, probably unlikely to start another social world because that's pretty hard. Unlikely to make a gaming world. At this time, there was already kind of like the to come beta releases of Illuvium and Sandbox and Wilder World, etc. And so to us it seemed like, well, either there's an opportunity for us in commerce or kids worlds or potentially some other things, gambling, casino, but commerce made the most sense for us, especially because we all shared this vision that like we can imagine a future ahead of today where you are attending a virtual fashion show. You're clicking on the clothes as the models are coming down the catwalk. You're able to see the item in rotation on the right-hand side. You're able to try it on in a virtual mirror. And in this future vision of ours, basically a drone will deliver it to you a couple minutes later. And to us, it seemed very plausible that people would want to socialize around commerce events, around immersive commerce experiences, and from there conduct the checkout procedure. There were quite a lot of learnings when we did like early stage interviews trying to figure out what we want to do, where we learned a lot of people are using their virtual land as a place to show and tell whatever their creative ambitions were. And very often we found that they were actually trying to conduct in some shape and form a commerce event or store or a combination. And so we were like, hey, look, we have nothing to lose here. 3D commerce is kind of like this like very future concept, and we'd love to give it a try. And there were some predictions we made, some predictions that were right, some that have yet to be proven, some that were wrong. It's been a really crazy 17 months so far.
Nice. So it's quite a new project.
Yeah, so we've been around for about 17 months now. Started towards the end of 2021.
But if I remember correctly, you already have working stores, right?
Yeah, so we're live. It works on desktop, mobile, and WebXR. Fully functional. You can build your own store. You can go to many different virtual store offerings. We've partnered with over 300 brands today. We've had over 12,000 rooms created by our kind of like hobbyist community. We've partnered with over 3,000 builders to date as well. And I've found some very interesting use cases where people have actually managed to sell out or like have like a sold out status virtual store, which was really exciting, right? I mean, that's really what you're trying to prove. So it's been super cool. Yeah.
Those are really impressive metrics for only 17 months.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I assume there's a lot of blockchain technology behind what you guys are doing. So maybe take us a little bit through all the ways that you utilize it and
Yeah.
Why you chose blockchain
Yeah,
to do
sure.
those
So,
things.
I mean, again, I'll maybe start with like a general story here that like, you know, the conceptually what blockchain and especially DAO communities are enabling in a new incentivized way can be very much compared to the early open source days where people are just proud to be involved with the project, proud to get the badges for committing code or being involved with the project. And when we look at it in the in light of, you know, how that has played out in incentivizing communities within
crypto, within general layer technology projects, it can be very powerful, right? And so for Space, what we decided is that, so first of all, it's on EVM chain. We've partnered with Polygon. We have something coming out with Flow blockchain for Phygitals as well in the coming months. Probably going to be on BNB chain by the end of the year as well. What we find really exciting about an open world concept, especially in line with kind of token enabled and the whole kind of like blockchain ethos, is that, first of all, the concept of an open commerce world makes you almost think of like this cloud free trade zone concept, you know, where people are conducting commerce in this alternative world. And we thought of like, there's two main ways that we think we're going to incentivize people. One is that by being an open world, the developer community and merchant community working with us are able to, you know, earn tokens from committing code, taking part in bounties, QAing the platform, gaining kind of a higher ranking of voting power by being constant kind of like feedback loops for us. On top of that, we really think that like, if you bring in more developers or if you bring in more merchants, there should be like referral-based tokens that you can earn from doing that. At the same time, on this side, we think it's just as important to get your merchant community excited. And so allowing them to build third-party applications on top of the builder tools, enabling them to monetize those, enabling people to create templates that people can use to build these virtual stores. That's really the kind of like shell economy that we want to build around the open world concept. And then in world, we have a lot of stuff. It's a question of time if it can all actually be brought to life. But in world economy wise, a bit different. So there it's about enabling people to have things like marketplace jobs, enabling freelance opportunities of being store representatives, sales representatives, walking around creating, you know, creator first economy propositions, and then like in-game fun things. So like build referral guilds, you and a couple of people together become kind of like a referral machine for the platform. And by hitting certain goals, you get to unlock a certain amount of tokens. The same applies to merchant economy. So merchants can build guilds together. And they can also drive traffic to each other's stores and unlock exciting experiences from that, both for themselves. They can unlock like tools or free subscriptions. And for their customers, they're able to. So we have this concept that like within store villages, if a combined referral goal is met, basically there's an unlocked experience that opens up in the middle. So there's really fun things like that. Also, like if you're familiar with many of the casual games, you know, you can like play with the claw machine or spin the wheel. And then if you lose, you can pay to keep playing. So it's somewhat thought out with some really great people about the two sides of the token enabling.
Okay. So there's, yeah, that's quite a lot. And then we haven't even talked about just purchasing stuff, right? Because I'm assuming all that happens with crypto as well, or are there other ways of paying as well?
Yeah, so I think the way that we look at it ourselves is that like it's really like a in-game currency for utility's sake. The idea is that you know, you should be able to pay in whatever shape and form you'd like, but the underlying currency will be the Space token.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Now, a minute
it's
ago,
like the festival ground token, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But a moment ago, you mentioned Phygitals. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that, you know, a lot of the stuff that's being sold will be NFT. So maybe,
yeah,
can you?
Sure.
Yeah.
So basically, part of the whole enabling people to very easily build a virtual store comes as well with the fact that you have a store manager or environment managing tools, which enable you to create event tickets, enable product sales, subscription rooms. And in all of these, you could actually make it token gated experiences. And in the case of Phygitals, we have created a smart contract, which is currently built on Polygon. There will be a really exciting announcement coming out shortly, where essentially we've built an end-to-end Phygital creator.
which in the first iteration, it basically allows you to combine a physical plus digital value proposition and allow people that buy the physical object in world to unlock a digital twin version of the same product. So essentially, phygitals are really a 2-for-1 value proposition. I think the dinosaur age comparative is for whoever still buys Blu-ray DVDs, you will find that there's an unlock code for the MP4 file inside of the box. And so for the next generation, an easy example is clothes, where you'll buy a hoodie from your favorite streetwear brand, and this will unlock a digital version of that hoodie that you can then, in the near future, wear on your Ready Player Me, wear on your avatar if you rig it on them. But in general, phygitals just have like a very huge use case. So we can come back to this, but in light of like the grand use case of it, I really do compare it to almost like a industrial revolution, from the sense that you could combine anything with the physical item to unlock almost anything on the other side. So two other convenient examples are, imagine you go to a concert of someone you adore as an artist. Let's say it's Billie Eilish or Drake or Steve Aoki. And alongside the physical ticket that you receive, there is either an NFC chip in the ticket or there's a QR code. And by scanning or tapping your phone to this, you are now unlocking a subscription room, a three-dimensional subscription room of that artist, which is basically a fan zone where you can access exclusive content, unreleased music, unreleased art, etc. It could also function as almost like, when you go to an ice cream stand and you collect stamps. If you become a super fan of this artist, maybe by going to 3 concerts, you will unlock a meet and greet with like a 30-minute video call or in-person experience with the artist. And then lastly, I think another very like consumer product oriented example would be, imagine Evian or any major popular water bottle company enabling almost like a gamified recycling game with every bottle. And by proving that you've recycled after you scan the QR code, you're kind of like going up in XP leveling points. And if you ever collected, for example, the Panini stickers for the World Cup or something like that, you know that if you hit a certain threshold, then you will win something. Maybe you'll get 100 free bottles of water or go to the next US Open match or something like that. And so from that aspect, I'm really excited about real world use cases for Web3 that will enable a new sense of loyalty to brands that is well incentivized.
Yeah, these are like amazing examples you give as well. It makes it really understandable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, I think, we've come a long way from the start of crypto use cases and many kind of like potential use cases that have either succeeded or failed. And it's very clear that like over and over, mass consumptions use cases are things where Web3 acts almost like a shadow player in the marketing. Right. And I think it's becoming more and more obvious. I was just at NFT NYC. I went to the Makers Place event and they've become quite bullish about phygitals as well, where digital art is basically inside of a NFT frame or holographic. And, you could sell this to anyone. They don't need to know that it's an NFT. They don't need to know about what it's unlocking or the authentication being on the blockchain. It's really about finding very practical use cases and embedding this technology. And I think, the sad but the good of kind of going to all of these exhibitions and conventions is that as this actually progresses to mass consumer, people will stop nerding out about the underlying technology and start getting excited about real world applications around it, right? Like, mm-hmm. And for this, it feels like being in the generation of any major protocol that was created, right? Imagine being there when like people were competing over what will be the IP address standard, right? Or the Bluetooth standard, and everyone's working on these
wireless media sharing solutions, eventually people stop talking about it and they start thinking about what will I actually share.
Yeah, this really, really reminds me of the times we're living in now with AI. Like, if you even go like, what is it, 6 months ago or a year ago, people were still like only the nerds, hardware nerds and software nerds were talking about, you know, all the different changes and AI. And then suddenly there's this one use case that just blows everything out of the water. And suddenly everybody's using it without even knowing what's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you're
absolutely
Actually, is there some of the hype around AI that your project can kind of siphon off on or work with, or is that a different side of technology that's not really?
So I'm glad you asked, because if we look at kind of like OG prediction sci-fi movies about what this metaverse or 3D internet will be. You'll remember if you saw the Lawnmower Man movie from way back when with Pierce Brosnan, the opening statement says, in sometime in the future, there will be basically these three-dimensional environments that will be created by artificial intelligence that are going to enslave humanity, you know? I think that, you know, aside from the movie and all of this stuff, I think I would say metaverse is more like it's a shift from the MMORPG genre in video games to a practical 3D internet use case for brand immersions, for brand enabled games, for many kinds of new ways of interacting with the world around us, especially as well with extended reality and augmented reality practical use cases that are coming out. AI, on the other hand, is almost like a massive industry shift, right? It's like a whole new way of computing, if you were to look at it this way. So naturally, with such a wide industry use case, there will be very useful use cases for the metaverse and virtual worlds and tools for virtual worlds that AI will enable. I've been playing around as a hobbyist in quite a lot of these topics, and also trying to close partnerships with players that are trying to make tactical moves for the metaverse. So there's quite a lot of people working on like text to 3D solutions, where you can like very easily prompt generate furniture like 3DFi is doing, creating environments like Common Sense Machines, or there's quite a few PhD students out there working on trying to really crack this the right way. Of course, NPC ChatGPT bots, right? Especially when they're voice enabled. I think like a very obvious thing that's inevitable for a good experience in a virtual world, or even for augmented reality use cases, is voice enabled assistance, right? Like, I'm bored. I don't want to walk. I don't want to. And I think this was also a big learning for space and all the metaverse startups, is that you do not want to introduce more steps in like processes you want to do navigation wise than what you had to do in 2D. And this is why quite a difficult challenge to like make it more convenient and make it more fun. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I very obvious is to be like, hey, Siri, take me to a current live event about comedy. I don't want to go and search this the way I'm searching through 2D, right? It's supposed to be a new utility. Another example is that it's constantly aware of what you are doing, of course, in a safe and secure way. It's very important. But what I think is naturally another use case is having you're seeing this already, where like people are introducing ChatGPT for product information so that it can act almost like an assistant in understanding and answering questions for customers who want to understand more. But let's say you're inside of Ramps' streetwear store, right? And now you're like, hey, do they have t-shirts in green and in extra large? And you don't want to have to actually sift through the whole experience to find out if this is the case. You want to be able to use this voice assistance to get as far as possible. And I think if we talk about this hyper-futuristically, that's where brain-to-machine interface becomes crazy exciting, right? Like you're just thinking about it and it's already giving you the information you want to know. Yeah. So in light of that, I'd actually love to just for 1 second, just turn this into a quick conversation, because I think between the time that we initially wanted to talk and the time that we ended up recording this podcast, we went from like a, it's pretty unclear, metaverse is still very exciting, to almost like a bubble pop of this topic. And now, again, there's kind of like good use cases coming. Some people have survived in the market and they're building their next beta or their next consumer ready versions of their products. And so with that in mind, you know, I'd love to just have a bit of a conversation about like the state of the metaverse, you know, what has proven to be wrong fallacies, what has proven to be right. And also just, you know, from your personal perspective, and then I'm happy to give you my insight as well.
Of course. No, take us through, like, because in our pre-interview, you told me that a lot has happened in the last 6 months that we spoke. So what are the things that popped out mostly for you?
Yeah, I think everyone became just a bit more sober about what it will take for this desired future vision to come to life. Right. So, for example, what we did together with Dirk Lute from Upland is we decided to create the Open Metaverse Alliance. We came to a very sober conclusion that, hey, you know, for this metaverse vision to come to life, or any sort of spatial information highway, the deep infrastructure needs to be built. Right. So these are things like, you know, what is the future of portaling between worlds, and what kind of a standard or protocol will be built around that, mapping all of these contents across the many virtual lands, indexing all of these experiences into some sort of database, asset transfer. So when I am going from this world to the next, am I able to go as the avatar that I was as I enter this next one? Or is that not going to be possible? Security and safety, right? How do I avoid ending up in inappropriate experiences or violence-inducing experiences or, you know, crime-orientated experiences? And creating, you know, basically a common understanding consortium with many of the other virtual world CEOs joining us to kind of make sure that all of these standards and protocols will be built from within the consortium, or at least proposed for the world to take a look at. So this is one thing, right? I think the word was out there way sooner than the real vision was available to people, right? And so if you look at what happened, there were quite a lot of worlds that started to come out. Quite too many probably remained as a landing page offering rather than being live as a product. And that made a lot of people question, well, what have I invested in? What is going on? And with that in mind, you also realize that too often the Web3 propositions were actually investor propositions for buying land rather than, hey, how could I actually first get the users and create a sticky experience for them to make this a more exciting proposition? Yeah. And I mean, look, everyone is kind of guilty of these considerations, especially when the world is moving super fast. There were worlds popping up every day, partnerships being closed on a minute-to-minute basis with major brands. So everyone wanted to move fast as long as you know, the party is going on. Mm-hmm. And I think what was really sobering about this is that for those who really cared, like the Decentraland guys, like the Sandbox guys, like the Upland guys, like the Alien Worlds guys, Metaverse, all of these people, for those that really cared about building something that's an exciting experience, this became like awareness at your front door. You know, like, okay, crap, people are here now. There's hundreds of thousands of people on our platforms, but they are not staying for all too long. What are they doing? And by the way, I'm speaking about also our own platform here, not really speaking for anyone else's. But in space, right, we had a very clear proposition about commerce. And with commerce came, of course, okay, hey, yeah, you have native commerce functionality. You can create these experiences. But what can get your fans excited and what can get you excited to interact with the experience that we've just built. And it ended up being that if there are not parameters placed for even the marketing of your event, then it almost feels like something that you could indefinitely visit. And it reduced the urgency to it, get involved. You know, it became kind of like a thing of like, oh, okay, it's live. Well, you know, I'll check it out whenever, rather than I got to go check this out right now. Right. And a lot of that has to do as well with like how advanced your features are and product is to make it fun to hop and jump and earn and all of these things. But aside from that, we realized, especially when we managed to get stores to sell out, that what we ended up doing right is that there was like a countdown clock. People knew when this event is going to happen. Number two, there was like pre-marketing to the event. Number three, there was on the time of the launch marketing, or even sometimes like a Instagram live by the brand being like, hey, we are now all going into this metaverse experience. Let's go together and like swipe up links and all of this like really important tutorialing an educated or basically non-educated fan base to want to come into this experience. And from there, again, creating urgency around what it is you're coming into the room for. So where am I landing? Can I immediately within my field of view see the call to action factor? Is the product here right in front of me, or do I have to walk very far to get there? And again, how many products are available? Do I have to run? Do I have to do this very quickly? Is it going to be any left? And so we started to realize from many of the different kind of like industries and directions that we had gone after, because e-commerce is so vague, right? That the best use cases are going to be initially around influencers, streetwear fashion, and beauty brands, because these are the people who are not only open to innovation, they're excited about getting engaged, and they actually have stronger value propositions, even with an alpha level product. So I think that was all of that. That was like very sobering and important. Also, I think something that like, truthfully, everyone kind of like underlooked is that like for a minute, it felt like there was going to be a major disruption to video game companies that had been around forever, right? It was like the new kids on the block are going to come and take out Activision and Blizzard and whatever in a matter of days, because we know how to build games faster than you, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And for a minute, I think we were all very, I mean, some of us more sober than others, but we were all very, very much believing that like, hey, yeah, why are these guys taking 5 years to build games? I build an MVP over a weekend, you know? And the reality is that, especially since the bubble pop, that it's very obvious that like building a fantastic MMORPG experience does take quite a lot of craft, does take a lot of industry knowledge and experience. And working with people who are aware of that from day one that you're doing your project was super important. I mean, I remember having quite a lot of discussions with our internal team. You know, we had people from Ubisoft and Call of Duty and Shopify who are still with us today, who, you know, they would be like, hey, yeah, but you don't just go build an avatar. You don't just release this land. You know, you have to think about what are they going to do when they're there. And I think that has been very helpful in our kind of like little race to getting things out and testing things out. It's also very important to acknowledge that MMORPGs for the last 20 years have all gone through these little roller coasters of relevance and then replaced each other over time, right? So if we look at, you know, Star Wars Old Republic, RuneScape, EverQuest, EVE Online, World of Warcraft, Terra, Guild Wars, New World, all of these things, they all came, Habbo Hotel, they all came with a wave of relevance, lost some relevance, and then something else became more relevant. And so not to say that I think there will be kind of like a repeating of history, but definitely I think there's a lot to learn from why did that happen. And very often the answer is that the activities became very repetitive, like, you know, sliding with my penguin down a bobban or something like that, together with my friends, and that was it, right? Or like we're trading skins and noses and hats in RuneScape. And the conversations just ended up being, well, okay, if there's a lot of people, it's fun to talk to strangers. But when there's not a lot of people, it's like showing up to a concert before it starts or a big exhibition before it's busy. No one's trying to mingle, you know? And these are very important factors to take into consideration and probably build smaller villages or city worlds, get it to become really popular and sticky before you expand it into massive lands. So those are just some thoughts. Happy to answer further questions.
Yeah, one of the things that I think isn't talked about enough in the world's experience is the hardware. Like, if you're talking about those spaces, like space, a 3D digital space where you can walk through and buy stuff, I always assume that the best way to experience this is in VR, you know? But as you know as well, unfortunately, VR isn't all that used worldwide. I mean, it's growing every year, of course, but most people still use their phone to go online or their PC. Some even have really crappy hardware. So how do you balance that with a 3D experience, and how do you keep it fun even if it becomes a little bit weird, for example, with your phone to walk through a gallery?
Yeah, I mean, look, great question. I think a few things here. So I think every once in a while, I meet people who have never done this whatsoever, whether on a desktop or own a headset, or even if they own a headset. It's quite interesting. There's quite a lot of, like, you know, teenagers that come through my house that are friends with my brother and stuff who, you know, they'll say I have Oculus, but they won't actually spend all too much time in it. And if I try and compare this to, you know, every major media hardware that has come out, often it is one or two major addicting use cases that make it a mass adoption, where people stop talking about the price of the hardware, they stop talking about the quality of the hardware, but it ends up being such a strong use case at a moment in time where people just acknowledge the state of the quality, but they still want to play it or they still want to engage with it, right? And my hypothesis is that you could blame it on the fact that we have basically had zero well-executed augmented reality use cases or mixed reality use cases. It's always been, you know, hardcore VR. It seems like, you know, you hear all kinds of excuses as to like why we're not in it. You know, it messes up my hair. I feel uncomfortable. I'm basically shut off from the world around me, where some of it is true. Maybe most of it is true. But what we do know is that a lot of people really like transparency mode, and they actually do tap on it to reorientate themselves or even walk between an area while keeping the headset on. So whether or not we like glasses or we like headsets, I think the use case is going to play a massive factor, right? Because even if you make sure that the entire population or the grander North American, European, Southeast Asian population ends up putting on the headset for at least 1 hour to do this one thing, that's already huge. That's like that major step. It's like almost like a big wall that you're crushing by doing this, because once you can get them to do it for this use case, there will probably be a second or third really exciting use case. And it's hard to answer. I really do think it'll be interesting to see what the mixed reality use cases will be that will excite people, because it feels like it's been forever since Pokemon Go, where someone else has really like blown the doors open for a couple of weeks where everyone is involved in mixed reality, and then stopped again, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
I don't know if you have any thoughts about this, but for me, it seems very clear that it's use case dependent factors. And it's sadly true that there's not enough really amazing use cases that the mass population is interested in. I mean, you do see there's quite a few like top VR titles like Beat Saber, like fighting Darth Vader, meditation apps, watching movies together in big screen, VR chat, which seems to have stayed consistently popular. But, and I mean, they get like 17,000 positive reviews, but at the end of the day, within my 20 closest friends in this region, two have done that, right? And that says a lot.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I think that's one of the major problems now with those virtual worlds, especially because, you know, kids are early adopters, but the most of the cases we have seen now were investor opportunities, right? Like you can buy land for 1,000 Ethereum. Like there's no kid on the block that has that kind of money, right? So to begin with, the most of the VR worlds now or the worlds that are being built now that sell land, for example, they're already basically not interesting anymore for people without money, but they are the real early adopters in case of like new technology. So I think there's a kind of a dichotomy there that prevents like this big push. And I agree completely with you that it's going to be this one or two use cases that just blow everything out of the water and propel the industry forward. And I think it's great to hear that you and your and Space are really trying to find that use case and hone in to what is really working and keeping people engaged and getting them to try out this new technology. So
yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I don't fault anyone who chose that direction, right? I think what was really smart about the land sale direction, just to look at it from the positive side, is it was one of the coolest, most useful crowdfundings we had ever seen for a project, right? Like, it's not a pre-order for a game that's coming out. It wasn't like a discount for a future. It wasn't necessarily a share in the company either, but it was like this beautiful hybrid of like, hey, you're buying the most valuable thing that everyone's going to need within our worlds. And if you are lucky, you are holding one of the most convenient places to walk to versus one of the most distant away pieces of land to walk to. And whether that hypothesis will stand or not, I think it's very clear. For the creator economy, land has to be cheaper. It's inevitable. But yeah, I mean, I do think there was something clever about it in a way. I think that where the assumption went wrong is that the people who bought them should have been also passionate players. It becomes really rough when they don't end up becoming like a referral channel for your business.
Yeah, I agree. It's just it's so interesting because, you know, it's new technology. And so you have to have these outliers that try and test new things. And then better stuff comes around. Like when the internet was invented, we didn't just have Google straight out of the gates. We didn't have Amazon. We didn't have Facebook. You know, that was way down the line. So I agree with the fact that it was a really interesting use case. Especially now, because we do have to try out all these different things, because it's not only world building, right? It's also in integrating blockchain technology, payment systems, NFT systems, you know. And I think that what you said in the beginning of our conversation about building protocols and interoperability, that is one of the biggest major keys, is going to be one of the biggest major keys to unlock people jumping from let's hope Meta does a good job and you can just jump from Meta to Sandbox, you know, and you change your avatar, maybe or maybe not, but you would wear the clothes that you bought in the store, in a physical store, somewhere else, you know. So, that's why it's excited to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. So, just maybe one more sentence on that. I think the very key thing to recognize is that even in the very, very early use cases of the internet, we had an ARPANET, which enabled major universities in the US to be interconnected with each other, look up data sets of information and books from each other's libraries, read some of them, and basically, yeah, hop through these 18 websites on one internet, right? The fact that we spoke so big of this metaverse word before we even had a ARPANET version of our own was really the danger in the game that was played, right? And so from my perspective, I like to create my own luck, which is why me and Dirk started the Open Metaverse Alliance. It's super important for us that some immediate efforts are taken towards security, transparency, user-owned information, and creating this first prototype version of a spatial information highway to really open the flooded, you know, open the gates. You know, I think it's incredibly important that the initial use cases exist for this to eventually propel into millions of use cases.
Now let's just circle back a little bit. So in our pre-interview, you told me that the vision for space was that it had to be a community-owned commerce platform. Does that still hold up? And what do you exactly mean by that?
Yeah, sure. So yes, that's still our vision. Yes, that's still our goal. The main value proposition and why I find it exciting, as I was saying, is by being an open world, and allowing quite a lot of your code base to be open source and incentivized by token, you're able to harness the power of the community to help build your vision. And so the way that I like to use a metaphor here is really any successful Web3 or DAO or open world project has a goal to try and do what Wikipedia was able to do, right? So here you have, with Wikipedia, you have a group of intelligent people who came together as a team, who started the platform, who probably together with some journalists wrote the first hundreds of articles, but from there enabled and got the community so excited that they ended up writing and real-time editing to this moment in time every single article that came out after that. And it became so powerful that, like, if I go and change Julius Caesar's birthday right now or death day, probably within a few hours, someone will go and correct that and send me a warning that, like, hey, you can't do that ever again, or we will ban your editing rights. And I find that so powerful, especially if you think about the most expanded version of that, where people are, you know, committing code to your platform. There's a board of voted on roadmap features that people request. People build them for you. People QA your platform for you. People walk around your experience and play police for inappropriate content and block it. I think that's really why I get so excited about the open world concept.
I agree. I mean, if you look at the latest, like, platforms that went really big, it's or games that still exist that are really big, a lot of them have input or at least some input from their community that is just directly or indirectly put into the project, like modding features for games or, you know, content creation on YouTube. I mean, I agree with you that will be what will propel things forward as well, not just like this one vision from this one guy that then hires 40 people or 100 people or 1,000 people, but rather 1,000 people who agree on a common goal and go for it. So I think that's an interesting road to take, especially to building new stuff?
I think it's also just like a smart strategy for this next generation of companies to be built, because otherwise you would need all the manpower in the world to build that opportunity. So that's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, I agree. All right. I think we've talked long enough. I've already taken up more of your time than I promised. I do have two more questions for you, and those are the ones that I always kind of ask. So what would your advice be to someone who is interested in starting a company or a project using blockchain and the technologies that you're using in space?
So first of all, for starting a new company, start it out as an experiment that you're trying to prove as a hypothesis very quickly with real customers. Don't sit in your own dungeon thinking that you are right. I think that's like one of the scariest and most dangerous mistakes for anyone starting anything. And make sure it's something that's real. You know, it's not like that crazy unique of an idea that absolutely no other human is working on it, but rather that like there's at least a couple people who are doing it a bit worse than you. I think that's really important as well. And then I think for anyone starting with Web3, I mean, there's a lot to catch up on. So definitely watch YouTubes, ask noob questions in Discords. But I think we are now in already the start of the next generation of Web3, where it became very obvious that we had to take a 2.5 marketing approach, which means find real world use cases and put Web3 in the shadow of the business proposition and kind of make it like a really extremely compelling opportunity in combination with the Web3 element, which enables also hopefully new business models for you.
That's great. Great advice. Thank you. And then last but not least, what is the best way to reach you if people would like to talk to you or about your project?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you can email me at battis@tryspace.com. I'm also on Twitter as @battissamadian. And of course, you can always connect with me on LinkedIn. So yeah, definitely anyone who has questions and wants to talk more, it'd be great.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Battis, for the really interesting conversation. I wish you all the luck. I hope we can talk again in like 12 months or 24 months and then see you as the industry leader, right?
Thank you so much. And thank you for the wishes. Absolutely. Hey, this was great. I think it's one of the first new year sober conversations about the metaverse. So it's really exciting to talk to you about this and answer these prompted questions. And look forward to talking again sometime soon.
Yeah, the pleasure was all mine, Battis. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Alrighty. Take care.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Blockchain Practitioners podcast. And I hope you learned something new today. If you are involved in an interesting blockchain project, feel free to reach out to us. Also, please like, rate, and review this podcast if possible, and share our content with everybody you think would like it. If you'd like some more information about us, you can visit us on LinkedIn or our website at blockchainpractitioners.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you at the next episode.